all we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
And welcome, everyone. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's Here We Stand, March 26th. And, of course, that was Brother Martin going to the mountaintop. Just like we're going to do today, we're going to go up to the mountaintop and look back at where we came from and how we moved mountains. 15 years ago, this coming month, on April 2nd and 9th, that's Palm Sunday and Easter Sunday, a handful of us occupied churches across Canada, in Winnipeg and Toronto and Vancouver, and forced the issue of the genocide of Indigenous children onto the agenda. And the miracle we did that day was a miracle of simple determination and courage and devotion. And in the years that have followed, unfortunately, the world has been inoculated to this issue. That's what the people who are guilty do. They grab the issue and inoculate it by talking about it, making it seem like they're addressing it and resolving it when nothing has changed and nothing is exposed. So in a way, it's harder to talk about it now than it was 15 years ago. Genocide, a word, is used all the time now. And it's used so easily. The word is spoken so easily, so casually, so lifelessly. The word means nothing to most people. To some, it's little more than the self-serving rhetoric of politicians and popes. But when I hear the word, I hear the tortured screams of little children that never stop day or night. I see a United Church clergyman named Alfred Caldwell electrocuting a five-year-old boy with a cattle prod until he dies. His body's tossed into a pile of other small corpses and then buried in a secret grave barely a mile from where I'd one day work in Port Alberni. When I hear the word, I smell the sickly scent of burning flesh, and I hear Irene Fable describe seeing dead children and even living newborn babies being incinerated in the Christian death camp furnaces that burned day and night. I watch as children are made blind in deadly experiments and others have their teeth yanked out without painkillers by upstanding Canadian doctors. I see other children like Vicki Stewart and Maisie Shaw battered and raped and left to starve to death by men and women who sing Christian hymns the next Sunday in church. I watch as Harry Wilson shows me the scar in his tongue through which United Church minister John Andrews shoved a needle when a young Harry spoke of the dead girl he found at the O'Burney Rus School. Through the eyes of the witness, William Coombs, I see a Kamloops priest named Brother Murphy throw a young boy named Tommy out a third-story window to his death and then threaten William with the same fate if he ever spoke about it. I witness the same William Coombs, the lone and stumbling survivor, too crushed to speak publicly of what he knows and of his own tortures, but somehow willing himself to against every odd, even when it means naming the Queen of England as a perpetrator. And I watch as the world hates William for it and finally kills him without consequence, just another dead Indian. I hear Jackson Steen describe how his testicles shriveled and died as he was sterilized under an X-ray machine at the Anglican Hospital in Alert Bay, along with all five of his brothers, who were of the traditional line and had to be sterilized to wipe out that lineage. I listen as Ricky LaValle sobs and describes being forced to bury the body of his brother Ernie by the same Catholic priest who had just flogged him to death. I witness the people of my country and its churches commit or excuse or pay for these abominations decade after decade, and still today without a flicker of conscience or remorse. And then, when the crimes are exposed, they destroy the evidence and the secret graves of their victims, whilst absolving themselves, rewriting and normalizing the wrong and getting away with their mass murder of over 60,000 children by issuing some paychecks and a glib apology. And I wonder how people can do such things so easily and still consider themselves and call themselves human beings. But I also remember how some of us fought so long and so hard to confront this murder and cover-up until the truth was finally exposed at an enormous cost, including the death of seven of my friends. But then I watch as what we expose is buried again and a false sanitized history of the Canadian Holocaust is reissued by the killers and adopted as if none of these atrocities had ever happened. And finally, I witness the world and everyone I know turn their indifferent backs on this carnage as if it doesn't matter, as if it has nothing to do with them or with the plague that's now sweeping the world and all of them. I know these things so deeply because my own life has been shattered by them. It's not another issue for me. It's all completely personal, for it's been my life for almost 30 years. And still, did the spirits of the fallen walk with me and struggle to cry out through my inadequate and solitary voice, knowing that our screams are inaudible to the legions of the walking dead, and that whatever is spoken and attempted now will not stop the abomination from continuing. And there now stands only that judgment that is upon all of us. So in these last days, remember as an epitaph that whatever justice has come from the seeds we sowed is only because they were watered with our blood and our suffering. Perhaps some of you will earn and redeem this sacred inheritance by your own sacrifice, the cost of your departure from this bloody land of no one. So today, we are going to look at how omnicide, that's the killing of all of us, comes out from genocide, the killing of a particular group. And because we didn't stand against that genocide, it's now afflicting all of us. If you live alongside evil, the blowback hits you. It's inevitable. I think it was Jean-Paul Sartre who said, the price we pay for conforming to modernity is that we remain dead souls waiting to be born. But it's more specific than that. If you live alongside evil too long, you diminish by it, and you're affected by it, just like we're seeing today with the COVID global corporate tyranny. It's a direct reflection and result of what happened to those children, and when you ignore it, you ignore your own fate. And so today, we're going to look into the legacy of all that, how it's affecting us now, and how even we, the people who are unworthy, frankly, of our own rescue, our own liberty, because we haven't earned it yet. We haven't stood by the side of the people we wronged and destroyed. But maybe some of us can earn that. And the way we do it is by fighting the system now with knowledge of the past, going up to the mountaintop, looking where we came from, and how we, a few of us, moved mountains in the right spirit. And we're going to look at that by listening to part of an interview I did with Owen Lucas, my brother in Ireland, as part of our Republic Alliance movement. And the topic really is, we entitled it, Toppling Thrones and Resisting Our Global Omnicide, Lifetimes of Lessons. And by that we mean many lifetimes are teaching us the lessons today that we're going to hear about, and you've undoubtedly heard about if you listen to the show regularly. It's a collective wisdom that comes from the living and the dead. And we're going to be sharing that today. Because don't forget, these are the qualities of living souls. You have an outrage that moves you to act. You have a willingness to die to protect your young. And you are incapable of looking the other way. Those are simple qualities, not of saints, but just of normal men and women. And it's time to recover those qualities. We who have been numbed by living next to murder, mass murder for too long, recovering our souls. We hope to talk about that today. And for those of you listening for the first time, we've been on the air here for many years, actually for 8 years now. And the bbsradio.com/herewestand. We're here every Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. And we're part of the broader Global Republic Alliance movement that grew out of our work in Canada. You can see all our work at Republic of Canada, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofcanada.org, murderbydecree.com, which has all of the hard evidence that I've been mentioning and that you will be hearing about today. And also write to us, angelfire101@protonmail.com. Now remember, in the upcoming month of April, there will be actions, especially on our anniversary, of the 18th anniversary of the first Aboriginal Holocaust Memorial Day in 2005 that kicked off this whole movement in Vancouver on Canada's west coast. And all across the world on that date, April 15th, it's a Saturday, and then the 16th on the Sunday, there will be church actions, teach-ins, and other actions to remember the fallen and how they continue to fall and how we are all next. And so to be part of that, write to us, angelfire101@protonmail.com. And I thank you. Here next is the interview with, I did part of an interview we did just recently, myself and Owen Lucas. Let it edify you, let it inspire you to go beyond listening, to take action for the least of our brothers and sisters and for each one of us. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. I thank you. We'll be back next week. Stay strong, stay clear.
Everyone has a sense of security and privilege around themselves, right? Stability to get through the day. That's how we've been raised to think. And if anything threatens any of those privileges of security, instant back off. For example, I've mentioned this before. We pass laws, and they don't want to go in and enforce them. They don't want to go up to a cop or say, look, we're not doing this anymore, we're doing this, because that would be to run their lives. So generally, there's no sense of actually wanting to govern their daily lives, except in the way they've always done it, which is build a little security for yourself, right? I mean, I don't know who any one of us who isn't like that to some degree, right? So it really requires self-examination first to say, how far are we willing to go? And realize, normally we don't want to go far. It's only when everything is taken from us that we have to. And those are the people we am at now, the people who've lost everything, like the people in this picture, right? Okay. They're mostly homeless Aboriginals.
Okay.
They're the ones who occupied the churches with me because we had nothing to lose anymore. And those are the people who are your own, that's your potential in there. 99% of everyone else have something to hold on to, and they're not going to let it go. Even if dictatorship is coming down, everything tends to make people more conservative, right, in hard times. So let's hope everything falls apart even more so people are suffering in a big way, and then they realize they're going to have to fight back and take their lives back, right? And learn how to do it in the fight. I mean, that's how you learn, by doing it, not by having an idea model about it, right? Which, you know, you don't do it from a good intention. You do it because your life depends on it. And so you look to people whose life depends on change. That's kind of the general clue, I think, in our work.
On April the 15th, coming up now, there's this Indigenous ceremony. Can we have the details? Give us the spec of that ceremony and occasion, anniversary.
Well, like I mentioned, that happened, you know, 2005. We started this Aboriginal Holocaust Memorial Day, we called it, to remember the genocide of the Native children, but it mushroomed from there into many other things. But on every April 15th, we do this. But this year, it's very important because we're not talking about genocide anymore. We're talking about omnicide, which means killing everybody. Genocide means you go after a particular group, in this case, Indigenous people, right? Omnicide means everybody's targeted, and that's what we're facing. And so we're kind of escalating the language, changing the language a bit to reflect our situation. It's omnicide awareness. And that's why the other date is June 12th to 14th is the 25th anniversary of our first tribunal into the residential school crimes. And we're going to use it as a date to say, okay, let's look at the bigger omnicide, the bigger crimes that's documented, do in a bigger way what we started 25 years ago at that first tribunal. So next few months, there's going to be those, we're going to be doing teach-ins, and not just in a room. We're going to go out, to give you an example, the church that we occupied in Vancouver, the Catholic Cathedral there that we went in that time, and right across the street, there's a big park. We're going to have a public teach-in. So we're going to get the loudspeaker. We're going to have music. We're going to be broadcasting to the people in the church, you know, and to the everybody going by, not only the crime and its ongoing nature, but how it's morphed in COVID omnicide society where humanity is being extinguished. And, you know, so, I mean, knowledge of the past is now a springboard to what we're engaged in now. We want to link the two. We don't want to have this artificial separation between, oh, yeah, that was 25 years ago, Kev, but what relevance does it have now? It's directly relevant.
You know, well, it's death by injection.
It takes a few survivors like me. Yeah, right. It needs a few survivors like me to remind us, look, that was the bone of a little girl we found at the mush hole, the Mohawk Anglican school, okay? And that's all of us, unless we, you know, kids frozen to death at the Catholic Jack school. You know, I mean, it's that's our fate, unless we know from the past what we're involved in. And that's why they want to keep wiping out the past all the time, right? So we don't know the way, the nature of who we're fighting, the nature of it, right?
Well, this is the contradiction or the paradox or the catch-22 of our adversaries and our enemies is at the same time that they're blanket killing the public, and like you phrase it, omnicide as opposed to genocide, everybody, you know, the public, we the people in general are now becoming at least questioning or aware of this shadowy, macabre inversion, perversion of infrastructure, of leadership that the world is yoked under. And their impossible situation, their impossible job is to maintain the facade and the deception at the same time as killing more and more people, you know, via their methods and their systems and how they're doing it. And it's you know, it's King Canute trying to push the tide back. It's just impossible to do that. So this swelling of awareness and this swelling of distrust of authority and the traditional systems that they've been brought up with is really playing into our hands, right? So if we look at individual cases, you know, you've got personal experience of it, of course, creating courts and creating verdicts and arrest warrants for and rewards for you know individual criminals. Well, surely the focus and the aim for us is to create more courts, right? To create these ripple effects going out and out into society to say, look, common law, natural law has teeth. It is effective. It can make wholesale changes.
In theory, but don't forget, you can't put yourself on trial. And because this thing that we're fighting emerged from us. It's our nature to have done these things, a nature of society. I don't mean individuals because, you know, the old saying is, as individuals, people are angels. As a group, they're a devil. And that tends to happen. So how do you put a system on trial when we've been part of it all along? You can't. I mean, you try to a certain point, but then people naturally say, well, oh, let's try these individuals, but how do we put our system on trial? Does it, like, what? How do you do that? It kind of escapes people's even thinking how to even go about that. The truth is you can't really. You can only do it symbolically. But you can create an alternative, but that takes generations. It's a long-term process, and people don't think in generations. They don't even think in terms of a year. They think in terms of a week. You know, what can I gain now? What can we achieve now? And it's a longer, as we've talked about, a very long process, right?
Right. As an analogy and a metaphor, you got a Jenga game, which, you know, metaphorically is the tower, right? And so over a long period of time, multi-generations. You know, these blocks get pulled out and placed on the top, and the tower gets taller, but more unstable, right? More precarious and volatile. And then in a moment, you know, the other metaphor is the dam bursting, but the tower collapses, and the slate is wiped clean, right? And this is where we're getting to. The political situation, USA especially, looks to me to be on the brink. I mean, I have said this, you know, numerous times over the last few months, but at some point the camel's back is going to break because of all these straws. And, you know, as this digital kind of, you know, you got these faux wars people see through, you got these injections that people are understanding all about, you got this oppression and surveillance through digital technology, especially digital currency just about to arrive, and people aren't having it. Okay, the sexual distortion of children in schools is a huge one in the USA right now. Everybody's aware of this one too, and they want alternatives, and they're still at that point where they're, like I'm saying, they're requesting and petitioning and asking and hoping and pleading with the old decrepit authorities. But, you know, they can only cry wolf so many times before the wisdom arrives.
And they're doing what they were doing, what Napoleon recommended you never do in battle, which is to see too many things. He said, a bad general sees too many things. I only see the main body of the enemy and stay focused on that. And, you know, have you ever read the fairy tale? It was a Dr. Seuss. He used to write books for kids.
Green Eggs and Ham.
He had those in yeah. He wrote a book called Yertle the Turtle. Did you ever read it? It's great. I used to read this to my daughters all the time. Yertle was a little turtle, and the king of the turtles wanted to build a big tower for himself. So he got all the turtles to stand on each other's backs and build a big tower. And Yertle was the guy right at the bottom of the tower, right? And you can, by analogy, think of who that is right in our society. But Yertle kept saying to the king, please, could you not be put so many people on my back? And he kept pleading. The king ignored him, of course, and kept paddling one turtle up after another. And finally, Yertle was too scared to do anything, but he was under such pressure, he let out a little belch, boop, and it shook the whole tower, and it all went bang. And there's a great picture of the king sitting in the mud next to Yertle, who's now got the bastard off his back, right? And in reality, that's exactly how it works. It just takes one person critically poised to give a burp and say, fuck you, and bang, the thing falls. But the last thing they want us to do is to know we have that power. So they say, oh, look at all the horrible things. Look at the power we have, blah, blah, blah. No, you know, like Sun Tzu says in The Art of War, you do not win by relying on people. You win by knowing the chi, the essential chi. Okay, so what do you mean by that is, what's the strategic situation? And know where to strike. That's what we did. How do you think we got Canada? These guys right here, the 15, 20 of us there, how do we get Canada to admit to genocide? Because we knew we were at the right moment in history, and bang, we just kept hitting, and the tower fell. So we got to learn from that, and that's what we're doing on April 15th and June. It's to remind people this radical memory we have, right? This of something that works. We know it works. We know it doesn't work. But, you know, that's my job now, to keep reminding people of those golden moments that the tower fell, and Yertle was liberated.
Yeah, the Jenga tower collapse, and so with that point in mind, there's you know, they say don't fight a battle on multiple fronts, right? But all these little cells, you mentioned it in our correspondences this week, that, you know, these small, efficient, fast moving lightning attack cell groups can do so much damage without being, you know, this huge, right, unwieldy, laboring blob of power. And so all these little hornets, if you want to use that metaphor, are firing in at the network, let's call it that, the tyranny, the cabal, whatever I say. And, you know, whether that's coming in at, you know, the child abuse situation or the medical abuse situation or the financial abuse, whatever it is. There's all these little cell groups which, you know, have no obvious connection to each other, but they're all stinging in at the same target. And for me, it just requires that understanding of law, or that foundational aspect of law, and, you know, perhaps some role modeling or some example setting or some demonstrations of how to incorporate a common law court and jury system and verdict, arrest warrant you know, it's pretty simple. Your book, I think it was the same one, the Establishing Liberty Common Law Training Manual, but it might have been the Hellraisers and Whistleblowers Shield, about the Irish situation. There was the quote, it was McGuinness, and it was can you run us by that quote again? I'd really like to hear that again.
Oh, Joe McGuinness, he was the survivor of this Irish Civil War. In the 70s, he was interviewed, and he said, when we really began to get our independence was when we established our own Brehon Law courts alongside the Crown, British Crown courts, because then we were acting according to our own laws, and we had to defend the courts in arms. And that's how the IRA arose, as a way to defend this new society they were building up from the grassroots, right? And once you did that, he said, once we knew that we established not our own laws but our own force, then we became a nation. And unfortunately, that's something people now lack. They don't think in terms of force, and they don't think in terms of being the law, right?
Yeah.
And that's, once you start those seeds growing, that's our power, right?
And back to Ms. Glastonbury, she didn't believe that she had any autonomy or power or
right.
Force within herself, and that they had it all.
Right.
But then what Joe McGuinness did there with that situation was conceptually created a massive dent of doubt in the corrupt and criminal system, and created right. the option, that conceptual option that, well, hang on a minute, if that's law and that's law and they're not the same, which is law? It's a great question to instill into people, right? Just that does so much for the cause.
Well, that's why Socrates said, and any good organizer does this, you never come in with answers, you come in with questions. So you say to people, well, what's the problem here? Oh, it's the landlord making us pay too much rent. Really? How much rent? Oh, you know, well, why don't you do anything about it? Well, we can't. People are too apathetic. Well, what if you did start something? You keep posing questions all the time to people, right? And they then come to their own conclusions. When you don't come to your own conclusion, you're a slave of somebody else. You're a slave of, and that's the problem with the internet, you're looking for an answer from somebody else all the time. You're not using this as a way to trigger in your own self-hardened mind, what is my answer? What is our answer right here where we are? That's what you need to trigger in people. Through an example, but posing questions. Socrates said, questioning was the source of true wisdom. You know, the dialectic between the teacher and the student was one of questioning, back and forth dialogue, right? And, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, a new synthesis arising out of that interaction. That's the way we operate. And that's, you see miracles happen when you start doing that. Like these folks here, you know, they had all the pain and the suffering and the story in their bones, but they thought, well, they're not listening to us. Well, you make them listen. You go threaten what they love. Then they'll listen, right? And we won.
and what we're seeing now, I think, as well, is this appreciation, if you like, particularly through the alternative media, in inverted commas. And they're putting forward all these faux legal, you know, it feels to me like they're very false. You know, we're creating a legal case to bring these people to justice. So the sort of underlying message is, you know, trust the legal system. The legal system can work, and the legal system is going to do the job it's supposed to do on the tin. But it, you know, you and I both know that that's total bullshit, and it certainly isn't. But they have to create. It's a little bit like the COVID narrative that, you know, that there is a virus. They're fervent and desperate to hold on to these conceptual principles that the legal system works.
Well,
the medical system works. And once that crumbles, once that keystone of the bridge is removed, everything tumbles, I think.
Right. Well, that's why you found in the common law movement, which really arose 10 years ago after we convicted Ratzinger in that first trial, people said, hey, it works. Let's try it. And you saw all over the world the common law movement spread. Well, the state moved in very quickly and co-opted it. So now if you look, 99% of the common law activists out there are all saying what you just said. Use the legal system. Learn your rights. Get back in there and make the system work for you. That way they control it. You're operating in their arena.
It's their premise.
The real revolutionary message was, no, you don't need their system anymore. You can be self-governing. I hear very few people say that anymore. because it's being absorbed, just the way the genocide issue was absorbed. Now, everyone's talking genocide in Canada, even the Prime Minister and Bergoglio, you know. So they move in quickly, right, to capture the language and the energy. Yeah. You've got to be continually reinvented, you know, from the grassroots.
It's essential that they have the Pied Piper on their payroll. Right. They're putting in these new Pied Pipers. Russell Brand, I feel. Do you know this guy, Russell Brand? I find him a very interesting character at the moment. He's seemingly like this kind of, you know, groovy, funky, out there, you know, good guy talking about the alternative stuff. How does he get on such mainstream shows? How is he such a mainstream celebrity? Well, the only reason must be is that, you know, he is one of these Pied Piper characters brought in to pull the masses in those directions. And so that gives me great hope. That gives me a lot of confidence and excitement that they're getting desperate. If you know, Russell Brand is their current leader of desperation, then, you know, we're making waves. There's a lot of good progress happening.
Sun Tzu would say that's a sign that you've won. The fact that they have to do that because they're following our lead. And don't forget, we always have to make the whole world follow our example and never use their language or concepts or anything.
Yeah. Okay, I'm getting into specifics then. So just as an opening question on this one, would you suggest or would you recommend that the internet, such as a Zoom meeting, is a good and worthwhile forum to create a court, a jury system? You did it online with the European, with the Dirty 30, right? That was an online court.
We did, and it had an impact because it had never been done before. But after that, there's no point in doing it. Never use, again, art of war, never use the same tactic more than once because it's uses the tactic against her. And so it worked at one time, but then we had to think creatively and try other things. Like you mentioned, the cell groups striking quickly where they don't expect, that's basic guerrilla war strategy. But no, nothing is ever really achieved in a lean sense from a Zoom call or internet contact, nothing at all, because the intro, you know, what it does is, you know, the medium is the message, right? It's the 3-second information bite when you're on the internet. You've got to get, like this interview, we've got to get certain ideas across quick because we have limited time. That's not life. Life is when you're sitting in a room and you see the person the next day and you see the situation in your community and you try things and it doesn't work. That builds relationships on the ground. You don't build relationships on a Zoom call, right? You think you do. It's the illusion of communication and substance, but it isn't. So getting back to the old-fashioned methods of face-to-face contact, that's the way you build anything real. That's experience. Yeah.
Wintertime, a couple of months ago, you and I were on a Zoom conference call, big meeting with a group from France, right? That seemed like a very healthy forum of discussion and communication. For me, that seems like an interesting template to translate into an assembly and a court. But what you're saying now is that it's been done. They've worked out how to defend against that sort of thing, and perhaps it's defunct.
Well, the thing in France is worthwhile if it's reflecting something real on the ground in the neighborhoods and the communities. That my impression of the thing in France is that it doesn't really reflect a lot of things happening on the ground. It's basically another internet community. And that's not to slag what they're doing, but to say, look, it's not reflecting what we need to build day by day in a community. And you don't do that through this technology. You know, even at the level of information sharing, what is information? Information doesn't equate knowledge or wisdom. And all you can do is share information on this medium. You can't really, like, you and I will only ever get to know each other when we're sitting around getting to know each other, being in the same community day by day. Like, I get a sense of you, and you went through a very similar thing that I've been through, right? You know, being targeted by the state, and we had kind of the natural affinity, but it's still the level of discussion, and, you know, you catch what I'm saying by this, right? I mean, that it's, sure. That it's, we have to build substance on the ground, and that means alternatives for people's life living. How do you feed yourself? How do you educate your children? you know, how do you take back the land on our communities and make them viable and healthy places? That's all only done face to face.
Yeah, it's for me, as for my personal situation, it's kind of frustrating because I'm you know, I've been exiled, basically turfed out of my homeland, and so I'm quite sort of nomadic, transient, if you like, and sort of building that community network is been very, very difficult over the last, you know, year or so. But
why?
To the question about you.
Why is it difficult?
Because I'm so new to every place I arrive, right? Who is this guy? This with an English accent.
Kind of a liability. It's
a stumbling block from the start. I have to keep explaining I'm Welsh.
there you go.
How's the Canada passport situation going? Is there any talking about you and I getting together in the physical world? I'd love to fly across the Atlantic at some point, and I'd rather not spend £90 on a British government passport. How's the Canada passport coming along?
Well, even more basically, I can tell you that you don't have to come my way; I'm coming your way, because the folks and this is for public consumption, it's good because. After June, during summer, July and August, I've already been invited to come to three spots in Europe. And, you know, the French, the Italians, and the Norwegians all want me to come around and help them with their stuff. So we'll get a chance to, you know, get together, brother. I'm looking forward to it.
And, yeah, that would be good.
You know, but in terms of passports for Canada, we're not at the point of issuing them because we don't have the size or the weight or the ability to follow through. We're still at an early stage. And, you know, I mean, people like the Mohawks and other Native people do, they create their own ID. They just say, I'm a traditional person. I don't need your ID. Sometimes it works. A lot of the time it doesn't. But, you know, the topic for talking over a brew some night.
Yeah, that would be good. and so, you know, you mentioned earlier on this discussion that it's very hard getting people to commit to the cause, right? To the battle. But there are these cells of healthy, nutritious wisdom and awareness all over the place, all over the world. I think, you know, just meeting quite a few overseas people, as I am with my work at the moment. You know, it seems like from Turkey to South America, et cetera, that. There are, you know, lots and lots of people very much on the same song sheet, shall we say. And you know, I certainly take the point that it makes a very efficient weapon or efficient strategy to keep it small and light on the feet. But isn't there also a benefit to creating a consistency internationally? To present to the powers that were the futility of their objectives, initiatives, that, you know, it's just a case of when, not if.
I think they know it, you know, quote they, people and at the top of the Yertle the Turtle Tower, they know very well it's coming down. I think their system is largely on automatic pilot, and you know, they're taking care of themselves. We found that when we took on the churches that their main concern was to save their own skins, these so-called leaders. And so they're very vulnerable as individuals, right? And so, no, I think that it's already, they're aware that there's two movements in the world, one towards this dead corporatocracy and the other people recovering local self-governance. And they want to try to co-opt that as much as possible to buy themselves more time. But I think they know it's inevitable. You know that old saying, and they think very short term. That's that old saying from, I think, either Marx or Lenin said this, that a banker will sell you the rope on Friday by which they're going to be hanged on Saturday in a revolution. Right. Because they're all just thinking short term profit. And, you know, that's the weaknesses of their system, even with centralization. It's still a very short term perspective. But, you know, that's why our long-term outflanks them all the time, because we're thinking in terms of generations. How are we going to raise our grandchildren to engage in this battle for this new world, right?
Thinking over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years or whatever, it seems to me that there was a lot of progress. There was a lot of we were making a lot of headway in terms of exposing these networks, these covert secret societies. Again, you know, Fabianism, Satanism, Freemasonry, the Knights of Malta, the Knights of the Gold, et cetera, et cetera. There was a real momentum in terms of that research and understanding making a beeline for blowing that wide open. And you know, in the movies, right, when they're chasing the bad guy, and he's constantly throwing things behind him, you know, chairs in the restaurant or pulling over the cupboards and the wardrobes to slow the pursuers' momentum behind them. Well, I think that's what's going on. Ukraine war, injections, this banking crisis that's coming in now. All these things are sent to keep it superficial on the surface so that everybody's, you know, sticking with the established and the historical traditional, areas of debate, party politics and, you know, medical funding and this kind of stuff. When there's really deep exposure and awareness kicking in, you know, I don't know if you've been looking much into the virus debate, but there's a huge wave going on at the moment where certain doctors are showing that the whole Rockefeller manipulation of education and health services being an inverted euphemism, obviously, and education, but this concept of a virus, you know, has never been proven to exist. That this idea of this germ, germ theory, jumps from person to person, is under huge attack at the moment. There's so much evidence showing that it's just completely pie in the sky fabrication of the truth, and it's all about the terrain theory is the opposing arriving concept that in fact. It's much more about pollution of environments than, you know, hereditary faulty biology of individuals that's causing, you know, this viral infections, so, bacteria to jump around. And so everything, you know, there's so much of the fabric at the foundation level of our understanding and our values and our truths, validity of everything, that's just crumbling and collapsing. So the question is, the universe hates a void. What's going to come in instead? You know, is it going to be Russell Brand or is it going to be Kevin Anna?
No.
Eagle Strong Voice?
No. It's neither. Don't think in terms of individuals.
Yeah, but they want leaders. They want leadership. They can't understand a world without it. Someone's got to take the leadership reins, at least temporarily.
No, I don't agree with that, because all you're doing is replacing one turtle king with another. And that's what we talked about earlier, the fallacy of putting individuals in to change the system. It never works. They get absorbed and change themselves. And it's like saying, does a lion consciously go out and hunt a gazelle? No, that's their nature to do it. The system, it's its nature to have war. It's its nature to have pollution and death. That's its nature. The question is, what are people going to do to be different? And, you know, the thing you're referring to, the Rockefeller General Education Board that redefined medicine, that's talked about. I remember 30 years ago reading about that. It's not so much as this stuff is new. It's just that we're learning about it for the first time. And it's like there's nothing new. The only thing new under this, and there's a history you didn't know about. Harry Truman said that. And, you know, like, it's true. When people say, oh, look what we've revealed, we haven't revealed anything. It's been happening all the time. And the question is, does that revelation lead to us breaking from it? And which means stop thinking in terms of leaders, start thinking in terms of us and ourselves and who we, the people, are, what we're going to create. You know, you get those brief moments in history when it happens, but then they go back into dependency on the father figure. And, you know, it's something we've got to learn to change. And maybe in an evolutionary sense, we're not ready for that yet. I don't know. That's an open question to me. Right?
So with the April the 15th ceremony in mind, the indigenous ceremony coming up, the decision at some point by those native peoples when their way of life, their world, their culture, their values were being threatened by this wave coming from the east into their lands, into their territories, into their people. There were decisions to be made, right? They had to decide, are we going to fight? Are we going to stand and fight? Or are we going to turn and become guerrillas and run to the hills and hide? You know, decisions had to be made for the groups, for the tribes. Let's call them tribes. Who makes those decisions? Well, it's the elders, right? So that is, you know, we're not talking about ranks and positions and management. We're talking about leadership, right? And leadership is a very natural thing.
Yeah, but it's not the way you described it. They didn't have chiefs or leaders.
It was democratic.
That was a European imposition. Even the word chief came from Scotland. It's not an indigenous term. They had consultative, you know, what Kanata means. We sit on a council fire and make decisions. No one had the right to tell another what to do. No one made a decision for everybody else. When it came time to war, every warrior could decide whether they wanted to fight or not. There was no coercive system in place. That's what we equate with leadership. Leadership equals coercion. Law equals coercion. No, leadership means wisdom from the whole group that we all implement together. Yeah. And that's a tribal way of thinking. And that's why it's so hard for people to practice, because we've lost that. It's been exterminated in us. We're trying to reinvent it, recover in our cellular memory. That's something we knew for hundreds of thousands of years as people. How do you think we survived? It wasn't having a leader that would screw us. It was only through a cooperative system that we survived over all those many millennia, right? So we got to do it again somehow.
So would you, let me ask it as a question. What's the difference between a tribal elder and, you know, this fake word chief? An elder is someone that people voluntarily listen to because of their wisdom, right?
They listen, but they're not their own actions are determined by it.
Okay, not coercive.
By her, traditionally, clan mothers, it was a matrilineal system usually, because the grandmothers in a village know all the kids. They knew who, you know, it's like we had that when the grandmothers in the Mohawk community in Ganawage, they took the chief out and spanked him publicly when he was ripping off all the money from the tribal council, and then they banished him. Humiliation. You use humiliation and isolation traditionally to reprimand people and keep the quote leaders in line. Because in a tribal system, family-based system, where are you going to go if you've been ostracized? You don't want to do that. In our system, it's the other way around. You got to screw people in order to survive. That's where your power comes, by screwing your neighbors, screwing your constituent, helping a few rule the many. It's mirror opposite. And there's nothing in our society that gives us a model for how to be traditional people. We have to relearn it from here and from the laws of nature. You know, what you see in nature, watching children and animals, just watch them. They teach you.
It's very serendipitous that you finished there with talking about the children in nature. I don't know if you watch Max Egan's videos. He's an Australian guy, but he's in Mexico at the moment. And he put a clip on right at the start of his most recent video. I'll try and add it here because it's really short. But it looks at how the inverted commas, the bad children in the state schools, in the conventional schooling system, which, you know, you could argue is very much a dictatorial concentration camp environment for children. But once they get out into nature, once there's a forest school environment, the naughty kids, or the bad kids, whatever you want to call them, the kids that are always in trouble, the black sheep of the group, quickly show themselves predominantly in terms of the percentage. It usually happens that the kids that are always in trouble in the classroom become the most influential, what you might call the leaders,
right?
You know, but not necessarily in a coercive way, but in a way that you know, the other children lend their ears to these characters, because they, you know, the resonance of truth is very appealing regardless of your age, right?
When I get the class outdoors into nature, the troublemaker becomes the leader. Not just well-behaved, the leader. I hear that over and over again. It raises a question. What are we doing to these kids by keeping them in the classroom all the time, in that cubicle, at that chair, taking test after test after test, canceling recess, canceling field trips, all with this theory we're going to make a better child if we do that?
And, you know, we also know that in the natural way to look at things is that everything is alive. And I remember when I was in one of the Chiapas refugee camps back in the 80s, there was this defrocked priest. I've talked about this, Brother Fidel. And he said when he first set up a church in the jungle, the Mayan Indians would show up and they would take all the communion wafers and disappear. And he thought, oh, they've stolen them. And he said, no, they were sharing them with the stream and the forest and the animals, because they understood intuitively that image of Jesus sharing himself is something they already knew. It's in nature. Nature shares itself with each other. Everything is alive. It's a big current of exchange and equality going on all the time. So they naturally did them. The priest scratching his head trying to fit it into a Western model, it didn't work. And so that's what we've got to recover in ourselves. I say to people, the best teachers, go out in nature, get the hell away from cities, and get your kids out there, like you said, right? That's how we raise a new generation, not teaching them stuff abstractly, right?
Yeah, well, I spend a lot of my time at the moment in a class, right? And I'm thinking to myself, you know, metaphorically speaking, there's a very natural river of language. Wow. that happens outside of quite a sterile environment that we call a classroom, right? And so my thinking with teaching at the moment is how do I bring the river into the classroom? Well, if you go to a river and you fill up a bucket and then you take it inside a room, Is that still a river? No, it's lost all its all its character, all its energy.
Especially in Ireland. Get them the hell out of there. Get them out in nature, especially Ireland. You know, it's the only country I've ever had visions in. I don't know if I ever told you this, but I actually have. I was in County Clare with my wife Anne, and we were pregnant with our daughter Clare.
I think it's in your book.
And it's a magical place, and not just because of my genes, but for me, but it's one of those amazing places. And I envy you to have children, working with children in Ireland.
My students are adults. All my students are adults. But the book that you write about,
the child
that,
in them.
Okay.
The child in them.
The child in the right, the essence of, but the inner, everyone's got an inner child, right? But the book you write about that County Clare vision is the purple one, Unrepentant.
One of them, yeah, I think so. Unrepentant, yeah.
I distinctly remember that section, and before I'd come to Ireland like I have now, that really, really stuck in my mind. But Kev, look, we're quite way over the hour. I think should call
okay.
it to. To hold. Great.
Let's
to chat again. Yeah. And before we close, I mentioned, I think it was in an email, perhaps putting together a bigger Zoom call with other delegates, if you want to describe them that way. What are your thoughts on that? Do you like that idea?
Let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, initially to keep contact, it's important. So let's do it, yeah.
You know, even if it's, a handful, 10, 15, 20, something like that, I think it would be quite good to just broaden it out, open a bit, especially now we've got the Zoom contract.
Good idea.
Okay, cool. All the best, Kev.
All right.
Take care. Goodbye. See you soon.
Thanks, Owen.
Well, John Brown's body lies moaning in the grave. I'll weep the sons of bondage whom he ventured out to save. And though he lost his life in his struggle to free the slaves, his truth is marching on. John Brown's body lies molding in the grave. John Brown's body lies molding in the grave. John Brown's body lies molding in the grave. But his truth still marches on. John Brown was a hero, undaunted, true, and brave. Kansas knew his valor when he fought her rights to save. And now, though the grass grows green above his grave, his truth still marches on. John Brown's body lies a-molding in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-molding in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-molding in the grave. But his truth still marches on. He captured Harper's Ferry with his 19 men so few. And he frightened over Jenny till she trembled through and through. They hung him for a traitor, themselves a traitorous crew, but his truth still marches on. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord, and his truth still marches on. John Brown was John the Baptist, for the Christ we are to see, Christ of whom the bondsman shall the liberator be. And soon throughout the sunny south, the slaves were all set free, and his truth went marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth went marching on. The conflict that he heralded, he looks down from heaven to view on the army of the Union with its flag red, white, and blue. And heaven shall ring with anthems o'er the deeds they mean to do, for his truth still marches on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth still marches on. O soldiers of freedom, then strike while strike you may, the death blow of oppression for a better time and way. For the dawn of old John Brown has brightened us today, and his truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth still marches on. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord, and his truth still marches on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth.